The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. This week, as cross-party Brexit talks continue ad nauseam, Downing Street has announced that it will table the withdrawal agreement bill, known as the WAB, giving MPs a fourth opportunity to vote on Theresa May's deal in early June. It's a high-risk manoeuvre for a government with no stable parliamentary majority, but alternative solutions to the Brexit riddle remain elusive, so Theresa May is crossing her fingers and hoping for the best. Also this week, the European elections are fast approaching, with some recent polls suggesting the Brexit Party could do better than both the Conservatives and Labour combined. On Tuesday, even the Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt struggled to explain why anyone should vote for the Conservatives at the European elections. As panic spread among the two main parties, the Lib Dems continued to build on their strong showing at the local elections with their rather forthright slogan, "Bollocks to Brexit," threatening the Conservatives for third spot. So how will it all pan out? And what are the implications? All coming up in this week's Politics Weekly. Now let's start with Brexit and the Withdrawal Agreement Bill, or the WAB. In an attempt to sidestep the previous three failed attempts to pass meaningful votes on the agreement itself, the government is parking that and instead pursuing a strategy that goes straight to the second stage. But it's a huge gamble, because once the bill is rejected at its second reading, it cannot be brought back in the same session of Parliament. So if May wanted to resuscitate it, she'd have to ask the Queen to prorogue Parliament and start a new session with a new Queen's speech and a fresh confidence and supply agreement with the DUP, if she could get one. That's why Brexit Secretary Steve Barclay said yesterday that if the WAB falls, the deal would be dead, and why most MPs think May's premiership would be too. So to discuss all this, I'm joined by Ryan Shorthouse of Bright Blue, an independent think tank and pressure group for liberal conservatism, and Guardian columnists Polly Toynbee and Raphael Baer. Hello all. So, Polly, she's having yet another attempt at giving MPs a vote. We've tried this three times. Is there any chance that it could work this time?
Yet another crunch, 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 crunch. I think it is just possible, that the Tories will do so badly in the European elections that it will give them an electric shock that will terrify them. I mean, they could fall to single figures. Who knows? And although it doesn't necessarily predict much about what the next general election might be like, it might be just enough to scare those real diehards who she cannot get to vote for her agreement into voting for it. On the other hand, it may have the opposite effect on some Labour people who might be considering supporting it when they look at a Tory party in collapse, possibly terminal. Do they want to do anything, whatever, to help them breathe back life into them? It swings and roundabouts. She gets more from her side, she may lose more from Labour's side.
I think also, actually, for the real hardliners, one of the responses they are likely to have to the Brexit Party doing very well is actually to ponder what was that Brexit Party prospectus. It was no deal, clean Brexit, you know, the hardest of hard Brexits, and essentially think, well, we need to, as it were, repatriate that idea, that vote, back into the Conservative Party, and that might make them even less likely to vote for May's deal, which has been sort of contaminated by this idea that it's not a real or a proper Brexit. And you do already get a sense that some of the sort of the more radical Eurosceptic hardline Tories are sort of flirting with some kind of merger down the line with this the Brexit Party, either culturally or institutionally. And I think at another level, there's just the sense that Theresa May, the premiership is over, it's done, and you need a moment, something where you can put the full stop at the end of the sentence and the paragraph and say, right, that's over. She faces this meeting of, this sort of convocation of Tory party chairs in the middle of June that will almost certainly vote a sort of no confidence in her. That's such a humiliation. In terms of the sort of the laws of the Conservative Party, it doesn't force her to stand down, but I don't think she will want to go through that process. And maybe I'm wrong here, but my reading of the vote after the recess, that, you know, when this thing comes back, it's almost as if they've recognised that they need to create some stage, some theatrical moment at the end of which they can say, and now she has to, now it's over, she stands down, because she can't sort of just wander off the stage with there being no, as it were, event to trigger it. But it really, it could well just be about the guillotine coming down.
Do you think that's right, Ryan, that it's creating a kind of moment? I mean, otherwise, there had been a feeling that the sort of immediate aftermath of the European elections might be a moment where she'd come under intense pressure.
No, I don't think that. I think there's a genuine belief that the local elections, the dire result there, and the European elections, which will also be dire, are the trigger and the wake-up call to some of those still hardline Tories that actually it's not about the Prime Minister now. It's also about the Conservative Party and the survivability of the Conservative Party.
It feels like a party having an absolute nervous breakdown, doesn't it? Prime Minister's questions yesterday, you've got Peter Bone, admittedly a hardliner, standing up and saying to Theresa May, I've got a letter here from some long-standing Tory activists who feel they can't vote Tory in the elections next week. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, the 1922 committee and also the National Convention, which is the kind of representatives of the voluntary parties, senior representatives, have both made it clear that they want Theresa May to go. The real institution that can really force it is the Cabinet, but of course most of the Cabinet are standing in the leadership election and they don't want to take the crown now. They want to wait until the withdrawal agreement. But, you know, I think there are still very ideological, evangelical people to which Brexit is everything, more than the Conservative Party. And I think those people, if they were going to be persuaded to come round the deal, they perhaps would have done that last time. I think they're still quite entrenched on the issue. So I think it's going to be very difficult for it to go through, to be honest, despite, I think, the genuine belief in number 10 that the local elections and the European elections could change things around.
They also think, don't they, Raf, the hardliners, that no deal, which is their ultimate outcome they would rather like, is very much back on the table. They think, again, they think, hold out, hold on, and perhaps in October we get chucked out without a deal. I mean, we've been here before.
Yeah, but it is technically possible, just in the sense that if you send, you know, a whole batch of Brexit Party MPs to the European Parliament and you get a Conservative Party leader who is absolutely willing to proceed with no deal, and particularly if it's Boris Johnson, who is so loathed and despised in Brussels and by everyone else in Europe, that the mood shifts on the European Council, and the current feeling where there is still a pretty... there's not consensus, but there's a pretty strong feeling that one way or another, you just need to let the UK work out its troubles for itself and not be seen to be forcing the UK out of the door, and also not wanting to do it. My understanding is that broadly there are two positions here in the European Union. One is a relatively hard line, the sort of French position, but also supported, I think, by Spain and some others and some of the in the sort of official tier. Which is that, you know, you see the UK as this sort of gangrenous limb that needs to be cut off. You've got things like long-term budget, new commissions to arrange. The project's got to move forward, and you can't when you're carrying this reluctant, difficult, stroppy passenger kind of basically vomiting in the back seat, making the whole car stink. Get them out the door. And then there is the still currently prevailing position held, I think, certainly by Angela Merkel, others in Germany and other countries, which is strategically and for the long term, ultimately, you need the UK to be in some kind of serious functional partnership with the EU, if not as an actual member. And the kind of UK politics, the kind of country you help to generate by pushing the UK out and facilitating a sort of no-dealism in Britain, a sort of Trumpisation of British politics, makes the UK even more problematic outside than inside. And that is not the strong view now. But if Boris Johnson were the Prime Minister, it would so look like that has already happened in the UK that the need to just get rid of us completely would suddenly seem much more just like a rational choice. But we're not there yet, I don't think.
But the problem being that the sort of MPs who would like that outcome have an incentive then to kind of hold out.
Absolutely,
they?
Yeah.
And indeed,
that,
they do.
And
absolutely.
It's their last throw of the dice as well on that one, I think.
And I think if we don't get Boris, we'll get somebody who has sworn that they're all for no deal, because I don't think, looking at the extraordinarily extreme state of the grassroots of the Tory party, I don't think they will select anybody for leader who doesn't swear blind that they're very happy with no deal. And then they'll have to deliver it, and then they'll find how terrible it is, and then they will find that this is not an ending. People who want no deal think, clean break, the end. But it's only the beginning. It means endless negotiations and rows stretching on for years ahead. The only end is to revoke. I've no idea if we can do that or not. But the lies that are told about clean break, people should really know.
That's part of the problem, Ryan, isn't it? There's an incentive to be quite hard line in a leadership contest in order to appeal to those members.
Yeah, I think the members are definitely very angry about Brexit. You know, they believe a vote happened, millions of people voted for it, it was an overwhelming decision, and that should have been delivered. You know, that's what a centre-right government you know, all of the hot air delivery, and they haven't delivered. So there's definitely anger around that. I'm not quite convinced that there's a sort of groundswell support for no deal in all circumstances. I think it's a bit more sophisticated than that. And sometimes there is a kind of caricature of Tory activists that they're all sort of hardline right-wingers. Of course, if you remember back in 2005, they voted for Cameron, who was seen as a more moderate centrist candidate than David Davis. So I don't necessarily think that they're going to go for a no deal candidate, but they're definitely going to go for somebody who is going to have an action plan to deliver Brexit.
It's more about getting it done.
I think so, yeah. I don't think it's the no deal candidate who will necessarily stand out.
Don't you think Boris is bound to get it if he gets on the ticket, if he gets into the last two? All of the Conservative Home and all of the other polling seems to show that he would walk it.
I think, of course, you know, you've got to get to the activist point and two people go through. So there's obviously the parliamentary party, and I think the majority are resistant to Boris.
Would they look those angry chairmen in the face and say, we're not going to give you what you want? I don't think they'll dare keep him off.
I think the thing about Boris is, I don't think it's necessarily just about no deal and delivering that. They think Boris is somebody who can cut through in public consciousness, has a kind of celebrity in his own right, and would win an election. I don't necessarily think it's about no deal. I mean, you're right that he's very popular, but I'm not sure it's completely connected to his Brexit stance.
I think the underlying problem here is that if it's not through May's deal, then your options are no deal or no Brexit. That is just, certainly over the next 6 to 8 months, you know, it's just, there is such a fundamental dishonesty now in both main parties about what the real options are. And, you know, I think you just have to give the British public a certain degree of credit for being able to smell that. You know, this is why I think a lot of people are very frustrated with Labour as well. Ultimately, the Labour proposition in the European election is a Brexit that doesn't exist, and if not that, then something else, which and we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Now, that, regardless of whether or not you think the UK should leave the European Union or not, that is not one of the actual things that can happen. And so it's just there's so much dishonesty baked into it, and so you have Conservative leadership candidates, someone like Dominic Raab, you know, others saying, well, we would just go and renegotiate the deal, or we take out the backstop, or we do things that do not exist as options. And for as long as we are in this process where the whole of the mainstream of British politics are two leading parties contending for government, one that's in government, one that in theory should be a government in waiting, are presenting the single greatest issue facing the country in essentially meaningless terms, giving preposterous, ludicrous answers to fundamental questions, it just sort of corrodes trust in the whole system.
I agree that there is no other kind of hardness in terms of direction on Brexit other than no deal away from the prime ministers. So this idea that you can go back to Europe and renegotiate the backstop doesn't exist. I think we're definitely heading in the direction that it's going to be a referendum of no deal or no Brexit. But I don't think we're quite there yet. I think there is still some mileage in a softer direction, hence the talks with Labour around customs arrangements, but also the idea of a kind of EFTA-based Brexit as well. With a new leader and a new direction, I still think there's mileage in that, but I'm not sort of blind to the fact that, you know, if Parliament is still in stalemate in sort of 3 or 4 months' time, then it looks like we're going to, I think it might be an inevitability that it has to be a referendum with no deal or no Brexit.
But would this Parliament, made up as it is, ever vote for a referendum? It hasn't so far. It's had the option.
I mean, I think it's going to get to the point where all options have run out. And although people don't desire a second referendum, it's the only way out of the mess that they're in. I mean, it's going to get to a point where there is just no direction whatsoever in the Parliament that exists that you have to have a referendum. But again, I don't think we're quite there yet, but I think we're definitely heading in that direction.
It's good to hear that optimism, but of course you are by nature optimistic because you're the one who always believes you can drag the Tory party back towards some sort of sanity as it gets madder and madder.
Part of the approach of the government in tabling the WAB is it hopes, doesn't it, to get this second reading done, and then that the process later on in which MPs can amend the legislation might be a way to work out some of these issues. So you might get a softer Brexit, or you might get a customs union, you might get a referendum, for example. But all that depends on them winning the vote on the second reading, which is the first opportunity to vote on it, isn't it?
One of the big problems, and it's been consistent certainly over the last year or so, is that inside Number 10, there is a terrible understanding of the way the Labour Party works, what its motives are, what its incentives are, how Jeremy Corbyn thinks, who the people around him are. And so, someone like Gavin Barwell, the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, has consistently massively overestimated the likelihood that Labour MPs can be persuaded to vote for what is essentially a Tory Brexit.
When it comes to the crunch.
Yeah, this idea that at some point you've got, their MPs, Lisa Nandy or Gloria Piero, whoever it is, sitting in these seats full of Leave voters, they will see that it's in their interest to deliver Brexit, and they don't massively like Jeremy Corbyn, so they'll just do it anyway. That didn't happen. I just think the failure to appreciate that certainly at this moment, one of the driving strategic calculations at the very top of the Labour Party is the idea that if you can just spin this out, sure, you'll burn off some of your own support and people will go and vote for the Lib Dems, but, sod them, they're Tories anyway. And you'll lose some people to the Greens. That's unfortunate, but they'll come home in the general election. If you can just drag this out, spin this out, then the Conservative Party breaks in half, is completely destroyed, and that is good for the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn over time. That's the strategic calculation, and it's nothing to do with delivering Brexit, whether you want Brexit or not. It's just a ruthless tribal party instinct to get Jeremy Corbyn or a Labour Prime Minister through. And if that's what you're up against, there's literally nothing Gavin Barwell or Theresa May or any Chief Whip can do to change that calculation.
I don't think there's that much good faith on either side. I think they're both sitting there pretending to talk and tapping their fingers. Neither side ever for a moment thought this was going to yield anything. But neither side wants to be seen to be the obstreperous one who breaks it up. So it's going to end very shortly. It'll be interesting to see the dance of the end game of who accuses who of stomping out, and neither side want to stomp, really.
Well, you've got this slightly odd charade, haven't you, where both sides accuse the other of not really being willing to compromise, and you sort of think, well, if that's the case, why not walk out? But clearly, as you say, no incentive for anybody
In fairness to the Labour position on this, I mean, the structural problem is still that ultimately, if you don't move on customs union or single market membership, you're not really changing the underlying structure of the Brexit you're offering. And the Prime Minister very clearly won't do that, particularly won't. If the Prime Minister simply accepts the sort of Liam Fox and further right would view that membership of the common external tariff is such a debilitating thing that it would essentially cripple British democracy and sovereignty forever, which is, a ludicrous position. But if you think that is true, that the common external tariff is so toxic you can't be in the customs union, then there really isn't a conversation to have.
Obviously, there is a compromise which is being discussed, which is you have a kind of temporary customs arrangement until the next election, say 2022. And then, obviously, you put to the electorate the different models in terms of trading relationships with Europe. So Labour would be a kind of customs union, and then Conservatives would be an independent trading nation. So there is that which is getting mileage. But why I still think there is something in the negotiations is, and it's not just all kind of pretend, is that really Labour doesn't want to own Brexit. And if it comes into power, then it still has to deal with it. Even if it's, if we have a situation which is that we have a referendum and there's Remain, Labour, if it accepts that, there is still this sort of feeling that they've betrayed a load of Leave voters. So I think this is why the message coming out of the local elections has been very much, get on with it, have a compromise. Because, yes, there's places which have voted Lib Dems and Greens who are very pro-Remain. But, of course, Labour also lost seats like Bolsover and Hartlepool. And I think any national party which wants to command a majority can't do that on a Brexit vision, on a Brexit argument. It wants to move beyond that. So that's why I still think it's in the interest of the Labour Party to try and sort something out and compromise so they can move beyond the issue rather than inheriting it.
I wish it were so, but of course they will inherit it. Supposing WAB got through, Labour wins the next election, they are going to spend whatever Corbyn thinks and hopes most of their time having to deal with the next stages, which are much bigger and more complicated than anything we've done so far. Whoever takes over, if it's Brexit, will find themselves mired in it up to their necks. And much as Corbyn might wish to get on with nationalising water and electricity and everything else, and lots of good radical plans and a Green New Deal, they too will be paralysed by Brexit if it goes ahead, which is why it's mad for Corbyn not to say enough is enough. We've tried everything. This is the end. It's time that we seriously supported Remain and had a referendum and persuaded people that this was all a moment of lunacy, 3 years wasted. Let's not do it anymore.
But of course, the MPs in those northern seats, the sort of, as you say, the glory Pierros or the Lucy Powells or whatever, would say, I can't stand on the doorstep and tell my voters that they got it wrong. I mean, that's quite hard, isn't it?
No, you can ask them. You can say, have you changed your mind? An awful lot of those northern voters have changed their mind, rather grudgingly, saying it was outrageous what they told us. We hate it. We don't really want to stay, but we could see that leaving is going to be even worse. It's not that they're happy switchers, but there are an awful lot of them. And, you know, for 2 years now, not one single poll has put Leave ahead.
I think there's an awful lot of those people, but I think there's even more people who are angry that the referendum result in 2016 hasn't been delivered. And that's why in the European elections, the Brexit Party are going to do so well. This idea that there's a political, I mean, I think this is an exaggerated argument, but this idea that there's a political elite who do not listen to ordinary working people who have voted and made their intention clear, that, for me, is where the anger is. And that's why people voting for Nigel Farage, all these kind of, you know, long essays about this sort of rise in populism and voters shifting to Nigel Farage. You know, I think it's really simple why people are voting for Nigel Farage. We voted for Brexit and it hasn't been delivered.
They won't come back to Labour and they may not come back to the Tories either.
Well, also, I mean, the Brexit Party's vote share is around where UKIP were in 2014. The Conservative Party has completely vacated the field. And it is interesting that we have reached a point now where the discussion of what constitutes a legitimate Brexit has been defined by the hardest possible Brexiteers. And, you know, obviously, my own view is that a very significant amount of the blame for that lands on the shoulders of the Prime Minister. She was the one who had an opportunity in 2016 and then again after the general election in 2017 to say it was 52-48, let's be 52% out, 48 in, and everyone will have to compromise. Instead, she said no deal is better than a bad deal. She normalised and legitimised a decision that actually it would just be strategically, economically, politically, diplomatically appalling for the UK that no serious, responsible politician in good conscience could actually do to the country. And now she's left with the legacy that she's created, I think. I mean, it's hard to imagine a worse performance by a prime minister, to be honest.
I agree. I think, it's been terrible judgment from the beginning. You know, it was a narrow referendum result. She could have reflected that narrowness with a softer Brexit and really sort of captured the mood of the nation, which I think is, you know, very positive about the economic institutions of the EU being in the common market, but very sceptical of the federalism. But, you know, she went for the hardest possible thing and raised expectations. And of course, those expectations have not been met. And that's why the hard Brexiteers are resisting, her sort of attempts to woo them.
OK, thanks all. We'll be back after the break to look ahead to the European elections next week. Welcome back. So next Thursday, the UK will be going to the polls for the European elections. On the back of the disastrous local election results, both the Conservatives and Labour are bracing themselves for a tough time. The Brexit Party looks like it could come out as the biggest winner, with Nigel Farage insisting that if his month-old manifesto-free party comes out on top, it will amount to the country voting for a World Trade Organisation rules Brexit. Nothing like a no-deal Brexit, of course. The Lib Dems are polling well as the leading pro-Remain party, but things aren't looking quite so good for the new kids on the block, Change UK. On Wednesday, the party suffered an embarrassing and poorly timed defection, with their leading Scottish candidate, David Macdonald, flipping to the Lib Dems. That's the domestic scene, but of course the elections are being held right across the EU, and extraordinary as it may seem, elsewhere it's not all about Brexit. We're joined by The Guardian's Brussels correspondent, Jennifer Rankin, to discuss. So, Jennifer, we keep thinking about the UK context for these elections, but they're Europe-wide, aren't they? And extraordinarily, not just about Brexit.
So everyone's attention is inevitably on these European elections, which are coming up now at the end of next week. And what people are really focused on is the continued rise of anti-EU populist parties, with all the polls showing that the two big blocks in the European Parliament, that's the centre-right European People's Party and the Socialists and Democrats, they're going to fall below 50% for the first time ever. So that's focusing minds and attention on how you would create coalitions in the next European Parliament, on what that means for the whole process of EU decision making. So a lot of interest in that big picture, and then inevitably the situation in individual countries as well. I also wanted to add that the thing that's really preoccupying people in Brussels is the question of top jobs. So once these European elections are over, then we start the process of changing all the EU leaders. So you'll have new leaders for the three big EU institutions, the Commission, the Council, the Parliament. You'll also have a new foreign policy chief and head of the European Central Bank. And this is a real political Rubik's Cube, because you've got to get a balance of candidates. You want a balance between North and South and East and Western Europe. Everyone keeps saying there should be more women at the top of the EU institutions, and then you need a political balance as well. So lots of people are talking about names and who might be sort of next in line for the next round of EU top jobs. So that's very much what people are focusing on here in Brussels.
And which countries are being looked at particularly closely from Brussels, Jennifer? Where is it that this sort of upsurge of populist or anti-EU feeling is most concerning?
Well, I think inevitably every country focuses on their own race, and to an extent it's still 28 national races. But a lot of people are looking very closely at France, where a bit of a shock in the polls for Emmanuel Macron earlier this week, when it emerged that Marine Le Pen's National Rally, her rebranded far-right party, is now edged ahead of his La République En Marche. So they're just Marine Le Pen now half a percentage point ahead in the latest, or won a latest opinion poll. So a lot of people are very interested and probably from a Brussels point of view, concerned about that, because Macron was the big hope for a European renaissance, for a new way of doing things in Europe. He ran on a very pro-EU platform under the slogan, a Europe that protects. So if there's a setback for him, then that will be seen as, to some extent, a setback for the whole EU project. Then also closely watched, people will be looking at the rise of the far-right League party in Italy, led by Matteo Salvini. He's expected to make big gains in these elections, which is likely to have an impact on the European Parliament. And then people will also be paying attention to politics in Hungary, Poland and Romania, where you have three governments on the right and on the left that are threatening the rule of law and judicial independence. So for people in Brussels will want to see, you know, how well these parties do in the elections, and also how well the challenger parties will do, which tend to be pro-European and want to Hungary, Poland, Romania to follow a European path with European standards on its judicial independence and the fight against corruption. So I think all of these races will be very closely watched, as of course will be the race in the UK.
I can't imagine the prospect of having a bunch of Brexit Party MEPs turning up is greeted with particular delight.
It doesn't fill people with joy, but that being said, Nigel Farage, when he was UKIP leader, he took 24 seats in 2014, came top of the poll. So people in the EU world know Farage. He's familiar on the current polls. It looks like he's broadly tracking to get a rather similar number of seats in the parliament. And he's not seen as the biggest concern, I think, for most Brussels insiders. I think people are more worried here about Salvini and Le Pen than they are about Farage and the Brexit Party. And it's the UK race has quite another interesting consequence for the European Parliament, because it boosts the fortunes of the Socialists and Democrats groups, because Labour are a member of that group, and the Socialists across Europe have been forecast to do badly in these elections. But the fact that Labour MEPs will be coming back to the Parliament helps out the centre-left forces. So that also adds a different dynamic to the whole race.
Jennifer, thanks very much. So opening it back up to Ryan Shorthouse from Bright Blue, Raphael Baer and Polly Toynbee. Ryan, imagining yourself as a Conservative strategist, is there anything the party can do at this point to avoid humiliation next week?
No, is the simple answer, because they haven't delivered on Brexit and they are not going to deliver in time. I think it will be very humiliating. Humiliating enough that in ordinary times, the Prime Minister might be, you know, thinking about stepping down. But of course, we don't live in ordinary times and most of the cabinet want her job, but not quite yet. But I think what Number 10 strategists think is that actually this will be a wake-up call to people that, you know, if the Conservative Party is going to survive and have a good reputation in the years ahead, it needs to deliver Brexit and it needs to deliver Theresa May's deal. That is the hope from Number 10 about these European elections.
And is it a genuine risk, do you think, that the party could splinter, could fall apart, could not continue as a kind of electable force. I mean, that's genuine live worry.
There is that risk. And, you know, things have happened in politics in recent years, like Trump and Brexit, which were completely unforeseen. But, you know, the Conservative Party is one of the oldest parties that there is. And it has survived splits in different decades and centuries before. You know, what unites Conservatives still is the threat of Corbyn. And really, they're kind of the party is lucky in an opposition because it is a very clear socialistic agenda from Corbyn. And there is still that fear that if Corbyn comes in, then it will take the country in a direction which is so against what all Tories stand for and away from a kind of market economy. And there is a genuine fear around that, which I think still brings Conservatives together.
Polly, should Labour be making more of that idea that Jennifer talked about, that they will sort of boost the forces of the centre-left in the European Parliament? Is that something they should be talking about more, do you think?
Well, of course they can and they should. And I wish this country was more oriented towards understanding Europe at all. But this election isn't going to be about that. It's going to be about Brexit and nothing else. And Labour is in for quite a shock, I think. The number of people who are, you know, long-time, lifetime Labour voters who will vote Green or Lib Dem or maybe Change UK and will not vote Labour this time. And even a risk that they might not come back either, because they are very, very angry at Corbyn sitting on the fence, at mumbling his way through what is the most important thing that's happened to this country since the last war. And Corbyn has had nothing useful to say about it. In fact, often quite destructive and not helpful. And I think he has a chance. If these talks break down with Theresa May, he can come out and say, "It didn't work. I've tried. I've tried my best. No kind of Brexit that we could accept is going to happen. What's more, there isn't going to be an immediate general election, not before these elections, in which case I now have to say, obey our party policy, which is we should go for a referendum and we should support Remain." Will he do it? I think it's unlikely, but he still has a chance.
It's very unlikely, Polly.
And that would save his bacon. It would save Labour and in shed loads of votes next week if he were to do that.
But in that circumstance, what would happen if we had a referendum and Leave won, which I suspect, I mean, just from the polling and that I've seen, that Leave won, a no-deal situation won, what would happen to the Labour Party in that circumstance? Because obviously they'd throw their weight totally behind a Remain campaign in that referendum.
Well, Labour would survive if they'd been united in that campaign for Remain and they'd lost. They'd just have to take it on the chin and do the best they could. But it wouldn't split the party. They would be facing, the whole country would be facing a dire situation. Labour would always be in a position to say, it's not what we wanted. We never brought any of this about. So I don't think it would do Labour much harm, except it just does the country harm.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I was said that Theresa May got everything wrong earlier, and I still think that's broadly true. But the one thing she's probably been good at in politics, and it might well just be an accident, is just in this last few weeks and months contaminating Jeremy Corbyn by complicity with these Brexit talks. I'm not sure to what extent that was some clever strategic judgment inside Number 10 to go, well, if we basically dip Corbyn's hands in the blood of all this Brexit processology, he'll never escape it. But it's certainly, you get the impression he has been very damaged by it. It's sort of like the sort of Chernobyl firefighters who go in knowing that if you just spend that much time with that much radiation, there's no coming back from it. And I think, regardless of what sort of the ideal position Labour ought to have or ought to have had, there's the sense now that the current leader of the Labour Party is wholly of this moment and this generation, the group that is failing to get it right. And I think it's now getting quite difficult for him to escape from that and to go back to being the person he was even in 2017, let alone the person he was in 2015. And I think what you'll see now is quite radical left-wing people in Labour, quite Corbynite people in Labour, more and more having the conversation first discreetly and behind closed doors and then a little bit more in public about what is Corbynism without Corbyn and how do we get there?
I Where I differ from you on that is that I think you're right that it's been a clever move by the Prime Minister and Number 10 to bring Labour into the fold. Because really, for the main parties, because it's so divisive, Brexit, I think they feel the best way to kind of not own Brexit is for everybody to own Brexit. And I actually think maybe on the Labour side, there is that feeling as well, which is actually to avoid us being so associated with Brexit, if the government falls and doesn't get the outcome that it wants, that the best way to do it really is to kind of compromise, and that, you know, it's been a kind of cross-party decision on Brexit, and therefore, you know, we kind of park it and move on. I think there's that sort of thinking going on, which is the way to not own Brexit because it's so divisive and poison chalice is for everybody to own it. And I think there's interest on both sides for that.
So, Polly, the sort of bearers of the Remain flame in Labour, some of them, of course, got so exasperated that they left and formed this new party, Change UK. It doesn't seem to be going awfully well for them so far, does it?
It doesn't. They look as if they're going to have a pretty miserable showing in the elections. A shame in a way for those of us who want plurality, who want a proportional system where it's possible for new people to break through. I think I'm particularly sad at the three very good Tory MPs. Their voice is now missing from the Tory party. They would be so much more valuable. Sarah Wollaston and Heidi Allen, would be so valuable now, and their voice is wasted. So it's been a bit of a damp squib. It doesn't mean, of course, that the Tory party may not split. It may split, in which case there is a vehicle for them. But I think their success will rely more on a fundamental cracking in the Tory party than in Labour.
And meanwhile, Raph, the Lib Dems, who have a very clear message on Brexit, unlike certain other parties we could mention, are doing all right.
Yeah, it's extraordinary what's happened really with the Lib Dems. I mean, essentially the sort of party, you know, a section of the electorate literally sort of kicking down the sort of dormitory where the Lib Dems were asleep and shaking them out of their beds and going, wake up, we're voting for you. Quick, come downstairs, see what's happened. Obviously that's a very unkind reflection of, you know, actually obviously on the ground Lib Dems were working very hard, and I wouldn't want angry Lib Dems tweeting me about what I just said. But that's the sort of perception, and I think there is some truth to that. And as a result, and that speaks to what Polly was saying, it was a strategic miscalculation. I think two big strategic miscalculations made by the Change UK groups were that one, that they had time to do this in a kind of loose, disaggregated, we don't necessarily have a clear leader sort of way, and so you have sort of Heidi Allen as the acting leader, whereas this broad sense that everyone knows that Chuck is very ambitious and would like to be the leader, but somehow this has decided to not yet be the leader because you'll need a contest one day and all these things. And you don't have time for that sort of business. You know, you need politics. You don't have a long audition. It's an elevator pitch, really. And they were sort of there jabbing different buttons, not deciding what floor they wanted to go to. So that was one strategic mistake. And the other was thinking that the Lib Dems were just flatlining forever because people hadn't forgiven them for coalition, and they were all this terribly old-fashioned analog party that was from probably something people broadly peaked in 2005 because of the Iraq War.
The anti-Brexit message of the Lib Dems didn't seem to land terribly well in 2017, did it? Which made people think, well, that's
exactly
obviously not going to work.
And so I think now it's probably recognised at some level by a lot of people on both sides that you will need to lock Change UK and the Lib Dems in the room and say, don't come out until you're one party.
The arrogance of not doing that from step one. When the SDP broke away, which I was part, it was clear that instantly had to be an alliance. There was no moment of pretense that you could stand against each other. And this was even more true of a tiny little group like Change UK.
And also, I think, interestingly, sorry to quickly, the Change UK, the problem that they have is that when the SDP did what they did, there was a lot of automatic respect that went to parliamentarians, particularly senior parliamentarians, people who'd been cabinet ministers. Now you've got parliamentarians who aren't of that stature, frankly. They just haven't had those sort of high offices. And Parliament itself is a diminished institution. And so they just don't have they don't carry this automatic sort of gravitational field of authority that the Gang afforded.
I think the Lib Dems did do very well in the local elections, and you know, it's right to applaud them for that. But you know, I don't think we should get carried away, because actually they lost so much ground in 2015 in those local elections when it was the tail end of the coalition.
Which is when those seats were last contested, wasn't it?
Correct, yeah. And, you know, I think unfairly they were punished for the coalition, but nonetheless they were punished quite intensely. And they recovered a lot of those seats from Tories in this local election. And of course, the local election is not nationwide, it's only a quarter or thereabouts of the total electorate. So I think they have moved in a positive direction in their perspective, but I wouldn't overplay the importance of it. You know, I think they were from 2015 in a very bad place.
And actually, I think the significance of the Lib, I'd agree with a lot of that. I think actually there's a lot of talk about Lib Dems taking votes from Labour. I'm not sure. I think actually the significance of the Lib Dem recovery is that sense that liberal moderate Tories who were a bit Remain-y are so appalled by just culturally and tonally the capture of the Conservative Party by kind of UKIPism, that's where a lot of Lib Dem recovery is coming from. And that's very dangerous for the Conservative Party, because if there is a feeling that you just simply can't vote Conservative anymore, and if the wildness of no dealism has sort of at least taken some of the sting out of the threat of Corbynism, then you could go into a general election for the Conservatives and you're losing seats like Winchester, you're not going to win back Bath, and all these places where traditional sort of small C conservative liberals or small L liberals, whatever you want to call them, voting Lib Dem, that could really damage the Tories.
I think also there's been a tradition in a lot of pure Tory areas where the small beleaguered groups of Labour voters traditionally gave their vote to Lib Dems. I think they might be willing to do that again. They don't forgive them. It'll be gritted teeth. They hate their guts, but they might.
I wouldn't underestimate also just the extent to which a lot of the judgments that were made in 2015 about people just looking at Jeremy Corbyn and thinking, nah, I don't fancy him much, and then voted Labour in 2017, but more or less lending their votes because they didn't want Theresa May to get a majority. That was then understood by the sort of Corbyn movement as an endorsement of Corbynism. And we've never really successfully disaggregated how much of that 2017 vote was Labour because of Corbyn and Labour in spite of Corbyn. And what we might have seen in the local elections and might be seeing now is actually quite a lot more of it was Labour in spite of Corbyn rather than because of Corbyn, and now those people aren't voting Corbyn Labour anymore.
Which means potentially Labour without Corbyn has a huge opportunity.
I think it does.
Almost whoever comes next.
Yeah, I mean, all the 2017 election was Remain in spite of Labour. I mean, that may be the other option which is going on there, but yeah.
If the results for the European elections are anything like the polls suggest, it would be tempting to look at them and say, my goodness, there's a huge realignment of British politics going on, won't it? It's often tempting to say that. But is that right? Or is this a particular kind of moment and then the Tories change leader and perhaps, as you say, Labour changes leader and we're back into something more like a normal pattern, whatever that is?
European parliamentary elections generally, you know, are vehicles for protest votes. They always have been. In this occasion, you're electing candidates for seats that basically the whole of the political system has said we shouldn't be even filling because we want to be leaving that institution.
And we hope they won't be there for long.
So you're so inviting this sort of weird, ephemeral vote, expression of rage that isn't about policy or institutions. So
it doesn't even have a manifesto of the Tories.
Yeah. So in that sense, I think it would probably be a mistake to read too much into it, certainly to extrapolate from it to what would happen in a Westminster election. That's one thing you definitely shouldn't do. Does it express a fragmentation and turmoil in voter allegiance? Yes, definitely it does.
The other thing to consider why I'm a bit sceptical of this realignment, this grand realignment, is, as I said before, you know, there's this kind of deep worry and scepticism about Corbynism, which does unite the centre-right, even though they're divided on Brexit. The other thing to consider is that, you know, Change UK, this new party, hasn't really done that well. So people thinking about moving might think, well, it's a bit amateurish and has fallen flat on its face.
Okay, you know, you lose your seat.
Yeah, and don't underestimate how ambitious politicians, but particularly Tory politicians, and we're seeing that at the moment with the kind of nascent leadership race, how ambitious they are. And for them, a lot of them feel the best way for power and influence is still through the Conservative Party. So why give up on it?
I think that's a good point at which to end. Thank you all very much. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Ryan Shorthouse, Raphael Baer, Jennifer Rankin and Polly Toynbee. The producer was David O'Donnell. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.